welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about government overreach, the divided Democratic Party, and little Marco Rubio. But before we can move on, just when you thought it was safe to make a phone call again, the government is right back at it trying to destroy your privacy. After the Senate, thankfully, but narrowly, rejected a ridiculous bill introduced by Senators Dianne Feinstein and Richard Burr that would have given the government access to all of your electronic devices, it seemed like perhaps the movement against a 1984-like society was succeeding. However, the forces on the side of totally unlimited government power over you are continuing to move. For instance, the FBI recently came under sharp attack for its use or misuse of facial recognition software. The FBI has a database of just over 400 million images. Most of them are not people who have ever been involved in any kind of criminal activity. Most of them, in fact, are driver's license and passport photos of more or less all of us. This database is searched constantly by the feds, and several states are now negotiating to use it as well. Use of the database requires no warrant, despite being more widely used than wiretaps. Now, you might say, well, it seems relatively benign. I mean, all it's doing is searching for faces and making matches with actual criminals, right? Well, not quite. Here's the real problem. It's totally unclear how accurate this technology is. In fact, it's already been proven that facial recognition software can and often does contain racial bias, and the FBI, nor anyone else, is producing statistics on how many false positives they get. So, the FBI can access, at will, photos of you and just about every American and use it to identify one of us as a criminal, even though we might not even be that person. Imagine the FBI coming crashing into your home in the early morning hours with a SWAT team, dragging you and your family out of your house, holding you and interrogating you, threatening your friends and your family to gain more information about you, then finding out after a week of investigation you weren't even the right person. Maybe it would help if you could say, contact the FBI, ask what sort of information they were collecting, and check it for accuracy. Makes sense, right? Well, the FBI also wants to make sure the facial recognition database and all of its biometric data like fingerprints will be exempt from the Privacy Act, which means they never have to tell you what sort of personal information they've collected on you, a person who presumably has never committed a crime or even been under suspicion of such, which also means that there will be no independent verification about whether or not collecting all this data is falsely identifying people or how many, or contributing in any way to a security function that could be considered legitimate. So, yes, that's right. The FBI is maintaining a massive database of all people's faces and fingerprints that they can use however they want, even if the information is wrong, with no checks and balances. And given that quote-unquote recognizing you could lead to extraordinary consequences, it's worth imagining what being falsely identified could do. If you're falsely identified, for instance, as a terrorism suspect, you could literally be put in indefinite detention for the rest of your life without anyone knowing. Yes, the government has that power. It could also mark you to be killed by a drone strike. It may sound extreme, but these are literally situations that the massive spying and killing practices the government has given itself the power to carry out that, you know, they really could do. If this isn't enough, there are bills in Congress right now that, if passed, would allow the FBI to use national security letters to get all your electronic information without any sort of warrant. That is, without having to prove you did anything or are any sort of threat. By the way, the FBI is already doing this, despite the Justice Department telling them that it is, in fact, illegal. So basically what's happening is their allies in Congress are belatedly trying to legalize their unconstitutional practices to cover up the fact they've been knowingly violating people's rights since 2008. Since 9/11, the government has amassed abilities that, quite frankly, reach far beyond Orwell's 1984 in terms of their ability to monitor your communication and movement. They have tied this to extraordinary powers to secretly detain and kill people with no explanation or proof. There is literally nothing other than the will to do it standing between us and a complete and total police state without any rights or recourse. Be afraid. Be very afraid. And just in case you thought the courts might protect you from this growing police state, well, They won't. And in a recent decision, the Supreme Court has actually made it even worse. In the recent case of Utah v. Streif, the Supreme Court made an astonishing finding. Mr. Streif was illegally detained by the police. The Supreme Court noted that. Once he was arrested, the officer found an outstanding minor traffic violation. And after that, the officer arrested him, searched him, and found drugs and arrested him for that, too. The Supreme Court, in its decision, said, hey, this is okay. So, now legally the police can detain you for any reason, even if it's illegal. Then they can try to search to see if you have any sort of ultra minor violation like an unpaid traffic ticket. Then they can arrest you, detain you, and search you. And if they find anything else, you're on the hook for that too. This completely eviscerates the Fourth Amendment that protects you from unreasonable search and seizure, as the language goes in the Constitution. For years, this was interpreted to mean that evidence collected illegally was not admissible in court. So if your constitutional rights were violated in the collection of evidence, you were good. This, however, has kicked the door wide open, allowing for evidence gathered illegally to be used. The impact of this is massive. It literally means that the police can openly violate the Constitution in order to arrest someone they wouldn't be able to otherwise. It literally means one of your key constitutional rights would no longer exist. The slow march towards eliminating all rights to intrusion on your person or property by the state has massively accelerated in the last few years. In the wake of Black Lives Matter, it appears the Supreme Court is taking preemptive action to help the police to deepen their ability to have total control over our lives. These issues are crucially important. Every day we wake up, we have fewer and fewer rights, protections, or ability to even change things. So be warned, it might be best to stay woke. And finally, little Marco, also known as Senator Marco Rubio, last seen favorably comparing his penis size to Donald Trump, is reversing his solemn pledge to never run for office again. He is, as he has now announced, seeking to return to the Senate to serve the people of Florida, which actually is pretty funny because during his Senate career, he had one of the worst attendance records ever, something ruthlessly exploited by Donald Trump in the Republican primary. There's been some discussion that to protect his opportunity to run for president again, he wanted to burnish his reputation as an effective legislator. Well, I'm not sure that's going to happen because while he was announcing he was running for reelection, he was skipping a foreign policy briefing for senators. And ironically enough, Rubio doesn't even like the Senate. He seems to not even believe that the Senate can actually do very much. But let's listen to Senator Rubio in his own words.
While as a senator, I can help shape the agenda. Only a president can set the agenda. We're not going to fix America with senators and congressmen.
And a couple weeks earlier at a CNN debate, Rubio really made sure to stress that he was missing tons of Senate votes during the campaign because none of the big national issues that he was talking about could actually be solved in the Senate. Here's what he had to say.
That's why I'm missing votes, because I am leaving the Senate. I'm not running for reelection, and I'm running for president because I know this. Unless we have the right president, we cannot make America fulfill its potential. But with the right person in office, the 21st century can be the greatest era that our nation has ever.
So there we have it. Rubio, who thinks the Senate can accomplish nothing, who in his own words stressed how he had said, quote, 1,000 times he was not returning to the Senate, is returning to the Senate. And why is he returning? Well, the New York Times, after talking to Rubio's advisors, had this to say about that. They said Rubio is a, quote, highly strategic politician with a restless personality. Mr. Rubio worried about a diminished role if he faded from national politics into a career of, get ready for this, career of paid speechmaking. And they wonder why people don't vote. Well, for the final word on this, let's hear once more from Senator Rubio.
And if we keep electing the same people, nothing is going to change.
And those were today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And to continue this conversation, we have an august, very well-accomplished panel of individuals with us. China Dickerson, State Engagement and Development, Head of State Engagement and Development at Emily's List, Bomani Arma, an educator and poet, and joining us via Skype, Rania Kalik, journalist with the Electronic Intifada. Thank you guys so much for joining. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having
Thank
me on.
Thank you.
So I want to start with this, because the big news that came out as we were preparing this show is that Caesar Goodson, the officer who was the latest officer to be tried in the Freddie Gray case, was, you know, let off on all counts, even reckless endangerment. They couldn't get him on that. And so I wonder, Bomani, I mean, how did you respond to this? I mean, you know, coming off the Rubio thing, I mean, we were joking, but it shows how cynical people are with politics. I mean, it seems like this Freddie Gray thing just confirms that.
Yeah, I mean, even from what you were talking about with the Supreme Court, like the way our rights are being violated happen consistently. They are breaking the laws in the way they violate our rights. And when we catch them violating our rights, they just find a way around the law or rewrite the law or reinterpret the law in a way that Freddie Gray was taken into custody by the state, died under the custody of the state, and absolutely no one is going to be held accountable for. Now, that's amazing. Like, I kind of expected them to keep the status quo that none of the police officers would be convicted of murder. You know what I'm saying? Because they like to keep the idea that they need the ability to treat black people in these neighborhoods the way they have to in order to keep us safe. But and the fact that they've codified it into law, basically, mm-hmm. that you can get away with it, you know what I'm saying, is amazing. And I think it's just a further warning. Once they start making official what they've been doing unofficially mm-hmm. for 100 years, then it's going to get really, really scary.
No, I hear you. China Dickerson, what was your reaction to this verdict?
So my reaction was of course. Like, of course, the police did nothing wrong. Of course, this young man who possibly had a great life ahead of him is a criminal and a monster and an animal. And so, oh, we didn't fasten the seatbelt for him in the back of the van, but that's okay. Oh, it's unfortunate he died. It's okay. It's all okay. And though the judge didn't use the words, it's okay, it is okay when you do not make anyone culpable.
Right.
For me, it's just an indication of, as Bomani mentioned, the status quo of what's been happening in this country and what will continue to go on until we have folks throughout the criminal justice system who, including the judges, who are ready to realize change.
Mm-hmm. And Rania Kalik, and I should note that you were actually in the streets of Baltimore in the wake of the uprising. I was up there with you for a little bit reporting about this. I mean, were you surprised at this stage in the game, or, I mean, just par for the course?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with everybody else. It's sad, but at this point, I am never surprised. I just expect officers not to be prosecuted or not to be convicted of anything ever. I mean, in this case, it is a little surprising that no one's even been convicted of just something like basic and simple, not even murder, just like throw someone under the bus a little bit,
mm-hmm.
just because the protests were so big. But at the same time, it's sad. It's like, that's the point we're at, right? Where just none of us even expect to see a guilty verdict ever.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, that would be, but that would be because, so if this police officer was convicted even of reckless endangerment, that would set a precedent across the country for police to be not only, you know, indicted, but charged and then convicted. And that goes against everything that the police, that the system stands for, right? Like, the police mm-hmm. are these above, like, very low standard individuals who we kind of empower to do whatever the hell they need to do based on whatever their history or experience is of working with, in this case, black men. So it would set up a precedent that this country is not prepared to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Bomani.
Yeah, and, you know, when it comes to the police, it's like, at the same time, you know, these people, like you mentioned, like, the police are empowered to actually do this in many ways. I mean, this is all, like, all these prosecutions are just for show, in my mm-hmm. opinion. Like, they are just to make it to sort of pacify everybody. All these federal investigations that never turn into anything. That's the point. Now it's like the outrage has sort of fizzled out. And by the time that, you know, by the time the prosecution, or, you know, by the time the conviction comes around and it's not guilty verdict, it's like nobody's in the streets protesting anymore.
No, I hear you. Bomani, get in, please.
The police department, from its inception in this country, has been about controlling black bodies. We're still trying to negotiate with the system that was birthed out of the oppression of this country and trying to make that better. And it's amazing to try to come from that starting point and to make it fair for everyone. And I don't think that's possible. I'm thinking about the news that we heard about what's going on in Oakland. Like, black people have been telling y'all for decades,
right.
decades at the Oakland Police Department is ridiculously corrupt. And so I honestly think black people need to take upon themselves. Like, we didn't buy into the system that we're under. You know what I'm saying? We were put in the system that we were under. So we need to have a whole conversation about what the system should look like from scratch. Like, I personally don't believe in the police department.
Right.
I believe in law and order, but I believe that we need to have a from the bottom, from the brick and mortar, what does law enforcement look like in our community, and erase what we have and start over again, because it was birthed from the idea of controlling black body.
Mm-hmm. Ronnie Collick,
well,
I think you're getting in.
That goes back to what's the purpose of the police department. The police in this country, their purpose is to protect capital at the end of the day, right? So, like, if that's how the way everything is structured, where it's all about protecting property and about keeping it away from the poor, from poor communities, that needs to be restructured as well. And onto like the issue, I think the issue about Baltimore that's really striking is because Baltimore is not like most cities, right? You have the leadership class is mostly black.
Mm-hmm. And Democratic.
It raises so many more questions about how we deal with this when you have a city where, in fact, like the black leadership of that city is a part of the system. Like, what do you do in that case?
That's a good question.
It's not like all white police officers,
But it comes from a black culture where we were telling our best and brightest to become part of the system, that we measure our success by our ability to integrate into the system. And honestly, sometimes, especially in PG County, it's gotten better and worse depending on where you are, but like black cops can be more intimidating because black cops have something to prove. You know what I'm saying? And because they don't have to think about, oh, I can't be racist because, you know what I'm saying, I'm the black cop. And so I think it has to be a complete rethinking from the beginning.
I hear you. Well, China, let me ask you this. I mean, one thing that's crazy to me is that a lot of these people who are, Rahm Emanuel is going to be a super delegate. I mean, that seems ridiculously perverse for me. I mean, just on that alone, I would just never under any circumstances, a party that will put the worst possible dude, and I'm going to come to you after we take a break, but a party that would put the worst possible cats out there. I mean, like every major Democratic official that's pushing mass incarceration, pro-policing, whatever it may be, is all going to be super delicate. We're going to come back to this issue. We're going to take a break. This is By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our conversation about what the Freddie Gray verdict shows, a little bit about the Democratic Party platform, future of progressive politics related to that, and I'm sure a little bit more with our very talented panel, China Dickerson, head of state engagement and development at Emily's List, Bomani Arma, educator and poet, and joining us via Skype, Rania Kolick, a journalist with the Electronic Intifada, among other outlets, also writing in The Intercept these days. So I want to just continue with that, China, because I didn't allow you a chance to respond, and then I'm curious what the rest of you guys think too. I mean, this whole issue beyond the whole issue of superdelegates, the fact that all the Democrats, they got the Democratic plank, we're for Black Lives Matter, Hillary Clinton talking about Black Lives Matter, whatever. Yet all of the people who Black Lives Matter is protesting against just about are getting ready to be superdelegates. China, how do you react to that?
I fully believe, and we were mentioning this as Rhonda mentioned, that the leadership in Baltimore is, predominantly black. I think black people also have to make a decision, and I'm not making that decision for you, about what party you want to belong to, what party is answering the needs of the community, and if you should form your own party. I do understand that there are some folks, I think it's actually going to turn into a large movement of folks who are about now not voting because they don't believe that anyone currently represents their positions on issues. So I don't think the answer is not voting. I think the answer is that we need to do better as people, training and organizing and doing all the things that I think we're doing now, and put someone up and then actually support that person. And so what has been happening with Hillary, Bernie, Trump, all of them, this happens throughout politics, is that folks say, oh, well, they're more likely to win, so we're going to jump behind that person. Well, if everyone thinks that, then correct.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. And so we have to be better about organizing ourselves, because I will agree that currently, and I think the candidates will agree with this also, no one 100% represents our positions at the African-American community.
Well, then let me ask you this, Bomani. I mean, do we need, I mean, you know, hey, this is the By Any Means Necessary show, you know, but Malcolm X, he said we need a Black Nationalist Party, and for that matter, a Black Liberation Army. But, you know, that being said, I mean, do we need to start looking more seriously, and maybe not just Black people either, I mean, just progressive people overall, at someone who does 100% represent us?
Progressives definitely need to form their own party. I mean, there are parties out there. We need to start really, the problem, the reason that we do it is because we're thinking in 2 and 4 year increments. Mm-hmm. And I know something that I, and it's something I even wrote about like 4 years ago, is I've got to start thinking about, how do I strengthen my son's choices, my grandchildren's choices? Like, I'm thinking of how to start a political movement, or how to be a part of a political movement that won't win in the next election, won't win in 2020. But at some point, we have to break this. You know what I'm saying? And so you have to start thinking that way. And like, the Democrats benefit from the idea that they just have to be to the left of Rush Limbaugh. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's like, that allows us to look at what the Clinton legacy is in his treatment of Black people, and look at even some of the things about the Obama's legacy and his treatment of foreigners and all these other kind of things. And we're like, oh man, that's horrible. But you know what I'm saying? But if we gave it to these other people, they'd be even worse. And I don't want to govern. I don't want to think from the lesser of two evils type of position. And I think the Democrats don't have to give the Black community a lot, as long as they're just a little bit better than the people on the right.
Yeah, and you know, Rania, I also, you come at this from a little different perspective as well, too. I mean, you're a Lebanese American. I saw a funny meme. I guess it's actually not funny. I laughed at it, but it's not funny at all. I think it was from Arab American News, and it was like a picture. It was like of a machine with two buttons, and the top of the machine says choices for Arab and Muslim people during the election, and button one is vote to put myself in jail in this country, and button two is vote to bomb my relatives in another country, and like that. But in a real way, that's the choice, right?
That's real.
Yeah, no, I mean, unfortunately, that's what it comes down to. I mean, in the most simplistic terms possible, yeah, like, it's, you know, you've got Donald Trump being like, let's ban Muslims. And then also saying, you know, you can't really believe anything he says, but, you know, also saying things like, you know, we need to stop bombing other countries and stop regime change. And you're like, okay. And then you've got Hillary Clinton, literally, like, you know, when it comes to foreign policy, I mean, she is like, she's a terrifying person. You know, she's already calling for, you know, bombing Syria and a no-fly zone there. And so, yeah, it does become an issue of bombing Muslims or banning Muslims. And I mean, again, like, it's not like you guys, I agree everything you guys just said, especially about progressives. I mean, progressives don't have a party in this country. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party doesn't even want progressives in it. I mean, I think the entire message of this primary has been, you know, with Bernie Sanders sort of representing the progressive base of the Democratic Party, the response from the establishment Democrats has been, no, we don't want you in our party. Get out.
So here's the thing. Like, this, I've managed campaigns, and I currently work with candidates, and I explain to them that this is chess, not checkers, right? And so while it might seem like I just gave you the description of two games, mm-hmm. right? And so you're like, this is not a game. This is people's lives. But this is how it is. And so, as I've said, I even say to kids, I'm like, okay, what currently exists is unfair. You think it's unfair. But in order to get to fairness, you have to play within those confines so then you can get in and you can make things fair.
But is that really how anything has been made more fair, though? I mean, you know, you think about something like this. I mean, look at fair housing in America. King got the bill introduced through protesting, trying to work through the system, and it died on its table. When King was killed, 120 cities went up in flames, and they said, whoa, and they passed the bill overnight. I mean, it seems like,
But they still passed the, it still had to go through a formal process. Like it didn't just happen. Like it's still,
I think you need both of those things. Right. I don't think it's one or the other. I think that you do need people trying to work on the inside, and then you also need something on the outside. And when it comes 100%. To, and we're at a place right now where it's like become so clear. I think this election, this past election has really clarified it for a lot of people, is that it's become very clear that our political system is owned by very, very wealthy people who control both parties. I mean, both parties are just completely corporately controlled. And that makes it really difficult to change things on the inside of the Democratic Party without pushing from, without having people pushing from the outside.
But Monty.
So I think an unintentional side effect of growing under the shadow, growing up under the shadow of the phallus of Washington, right, is that an unfortunate side effect is that I don't believe that you should always play the rules. That's not what our founding fathers did.
Mm.
That is completely not what they did.
They tore up the rule book.
They look at the book like, F y'all, I don't like your rules.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I live under a statue to this man's phallus. And he's great because he was like, I don't like what's going on and I'm going to try to work around it, but if not, it's gonna have to change. You know what I'm saying?
And so yeah. And I'm gonna build a big monument to let you know how hard I am.
You're talking about you're talking about George Washington.
Right, right.
So this is still a white man with property, with mm-hmm. so he still has power to say, I don't give a shit, this is how things are gonna go. Because he had the privilege to do that. I'm talking
but he also
about
had
people
guns.
And
yeah,
guns.
So I'm
yes,
talking
crucial
about,
element.
Well, power.
Right.
So I'm talking about people who are not in power. How do they need people, which is why I totally object to this thing that black folks can do everything, can make change by themselves. I 100% disagree with that. We have to work together with folks who are currently in power, which also means putting some of our folks in power, to make change. It's not just going to happen. Oppressed people, as oppressed people, do not get themselves out of oppression.
Well, I think that it's like, I don't think it's one or the other. I think you need both those things.
Yeah.
You need, like, it's like people in power aren't going to do anything for you unless you demand it.
Right, correct.
There has to be a reason, they have to have a reason to. But then at the same time, you can't do it without some people, at least some allies within the power structure,
right.
You know, throwing you some bones. Like, but I think that, you know, when it comes to the parties, I think that we're in a dire situation right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say dire is because, you know, it's not like this is 20 or 30 years ago. It's like, you know, and I'm moving a little off topic here, but like when I think about climate change,
that's on
and
topic.
The fact that there's still little time.
Yeah.
Well, it's like that issue is dire. It's like you do have just a couple of years. I mean, I think that 2020, and I could be wrong on this, but something around 2020 is like a, you know, like that's sort of mm-hmm. like the cutoff year when we have to have carbon emissions down by this much or else,
yeah.
You know, or else it's game over.
Yeah,
so
but Monty, go ahead.
So I don't know how far down into the by any means necessary wormhole we want to get into.
We can get as deep into the wormhole as we want to go.
But how deep
is the Atlantis?
But you have to negotiate power when you're a minority.
Okay.
We are not minorities. Malcolm X was a Pan-Africanist.
Mm.
We are not minorities. There are more of us than them.
But you just have to think of yourself not as an American in
yeah,
a way.
That's how they think. That's
you know,
why
they go to Bilderberg and all this. They linking up. They, if you got
right.
money, they link. I mean, I think, Rhonda, you pointed to this. They're linking up the people with big money regardless of country. But we're still in here like, oh, you know, we're 30%. Like, nah.
Like, Exactly. Like, building connections. I mean, and I'm at the very beginning of my stages of doing this, right? But the dream of those great African leaders was, like, that's one of the reasons I don't consider myself African-American. Like, I see it as an identifier, but I'm black. Because African-American makes me a minority. Being black connects me to Africa, connects me to the Caribbean, connects me to South America, and all the victims of this imperialist system, you know what I'm saying? We outnumber mm-hmm. them. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
so we start thinking about it. And it ends up being a long game.
Yeah,
but,
and Rania, let me flip this to you to actually change it, because I think this is an interesting point. You know, is this actually part of the reason why, I mean, obviously the people who support Israel are self-interested in getting rid of BDS. But it almost seems like it's a little bit deeper than that, because the ties that are being made, I think there's been 5 or 6 delegations, some of them, I think 30 activists, you know, mainly black, but others coming from America, going to Palestine, making those people-to-people links through the medium of BDS. I mean, it seems like that might be part of why they're going so hard. Like, it's almost a little deeper than Israel. It's like what it represents to have these linkages growing up across the world.
Yeah, and I think it's also, you're right, it's also a recognition that the oppressor is working together. Mm-hmm. So it's like there's actual tangible connections. It's like, yeah, like we're all oppressed in their sort of similar ways that we are, but it's bigger, it's actually deeper than that because, for example, like almost every single police department in the U.S. Since 9/11 has sent senior commanders to train in Israel to learn from Israeli security, Israeli mm-hmm. soldiers who are occupying, like literally involved in carrying out illegal occupation, to learn from them and then bring what they learn back to the U.S. and apply it to their own departments. And obviously, like, you know, U.S. police departments are already terrible as it is. The last thing you need is them also right. seeking advice from a country that's involved in daily human rights and international law violations.
A country whose law enforcement is based on us versus them.
Yeah.
Literally, yes. Literally. Exactly. And so those are like tangible connections that I think are and you know, Israel is like the sort of hub, the world hub of repression technology at the moment, because like that's literally what their entire economy is built around, is like creating new ways to control people with technology.
Right.
So like things like that, you know, that's I think that like really is you know, it's also, yes, the similarities and oppressions, but also that shows you like the U.S. and Israel and elites all over the world are working together. Like, it's funny. I mean, even in the Middle East, you know, the Middle East has experienced a lot of, you know, imperialism from the U.S., but mm-hmm. you also have certain Middle Eastern countries whose wealthy billionaire monarchs right. are best friends with our leaders.
Best friends so with Hillary Clinton, the number one defender of women's rights around the world. But, you know, you just got to understand this. It's complicated in Saudi Arabia. You can't just, I know women can't drive, but you just can't just let them drive. I mean, that's you can't do that.
Look, they might be the number one funder of terrorism in the world, but look, it's complicated.
So I like how all this is really tying in. So like I wrote a blog about this a couple years ago. I only voted for Barack Obama once. Mm-hmm. I didn't vote for him in 2012. I voted for Jill Stein. It's actually coming convenient. It's become convenient that I voted for Jill Stein because people have argued against me like, oh, you don't vote for Hillary because she's a woman. And I'm like, hey. It's not even what I planned on the first time, but hey, it worked out. But there were three things, and it was a moment in the Democratic National Convention. I don't know if you remember this moment when they were trying to add an addendum to the plank about how the Democrats feel about the state of Israel. I don't remember exact details of it. Yes, they brought it up to a vote, and you could tell from the cheers in the crowd that it wasn't it was contested. They might have had to do it a couple of times, and you could see the people leading the convention being like, okay, we're just going to move on because this wasn't even supposed to be contested. We thought we were doing an addendum to get rid of Sean Hannity talking about how we talk about Israel.
Right.
And I realized that I'm compromising too many things. There's three things that the Democrats are for that I'm against, and that, like, I could really use healthcare. Like, I really could.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But the principle won't allow me to, like, support them. So I'm against the war on drugs, I'm against the war on terror, and I'm against the war on Palestine. And the Democrats are for all three of those. They're making some leeway on some of them, but like it's like I can't compromise.
All right. We're going to go to our in-house Democratic Party expert, China Dickerson.
Oh, my goodness, guys. Okay. So I am going to give you the solution to the problem. This is the solution to all of the problems.
Oh, here we go.
Solution to all the problems.
So wait, could you potentially be, are you a delegate? Are you in play to be president?
No, I am not. Here's the solution to oppression. I'm giving it to you. All of the folks who are oppressed, and this is, so to preface, this is why I believe a lot of the Israeli, the organizations, and I'm not going to name them, but the organizations that are like pro-Israel.
AIPAC, J Street.
that are afraid of folks like Angela Davis and other folks who are stepping up is because they're thinking, oh my God, there's this large group of people, to Bomani's point, who are African descent, and it's so many of them, and they're all going to come together, and this is going to be bad for us. Like, this is why they're scared, because they think we have numbers and we have influence, even though we don't think we have numbers and influence, but they recognize that. And so they're scared. So the solution to the problem is get our asses together, because then that's when we have the power, right? So we don't have the power, as Bomani said, the 13 to 15% of African Americans in this country. But if we all got together as people of the diaspora, people of African descent, then while we are not the Koch brothers, our money together would be larger. But the issue is there's so many different dynamics and types of Black folks that we have not decided to come together to make change. But my point is other countries, other groups of folks have recognized that we do have power if only if we come together.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess Ben Carson is out there. He will not come together with us. Go ahead.
There you go.
Well, that also applies, like, I mean, that also applies in a way to to like the U.S. here, like just not even, I mean, you know, obviously I care about the rest of the world, but even just speaking, you know, in the U.S., when you have people, when it comes to the economy, who are economically oppressed in this country, I think that that's also something that can be really powerful as well, is when you have people coming together across like whether it's racial lines or gender lines or like sexuality lines or whatever it may be. And finding that they do have common interests, like they all need healthcare. That's one
really basic one for sure. And we're gonna take a break, but we're gonna come back with more of this. You are listening to the By Any Means Necessary show on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we continue to be joined in this conversation by China Dickerson from Emily's List, Rania Kallik, journalist with the Electronic Intifada, and Bomani Arma, educator and poet. And I have to give him a shout out. Unfortunately, due to the oppressive laws of the FCC in America, we couldn't play it. But this is like the most famous brother we've ever had on the show. The read a book video.
Bomani.
Just go on YouTube, read a book. I actually thought that Bomani was like in Hollywood making millions of dollars.
Yeah. He should be.
Shout out Howard University. That's how I found out China Dickerson. And also a grad, our network of alumnus passed it to me. But, you know, I just so many different issues that we could touch on. But I want to continue this a little bit about the way the Israel-Palestine issue has been working in the Democratic Party, because and I hear you, China. Your last point was that the way to solve all oppression, which I guess I agree with, is for all oppressed people to come together. I believe that was Malcolm X's solution. Mm-hmm. But and so I wonder.
Oh, was it? Oh, I'm a good company.
No, completely.
Wow. And you went to Howard University.
Good job.
Like, that's like, you're not really helping us out right now. This is like.
I thought you were going to contest that you're the first one to come up with it. That's why I was like,
I was like, whoa, like Black Panther. It's copyright in here.
Marcus Garvey.
This is just working off common creative license on ideological ideas out here. You know, but I wonder.
That's hilarious.
You know, I wonder two things. And Rania, I'll just start with you. I mean, looking at this, and this is an issue that obviously you really are one of the, you know, people on the forefront of the issue of Palestine BDS in this country. You know, the platform piece. I mean, I guess there's two sides, and I don't know how to feel. So maybe y'all can help me. I mean, on the one side, like the platform is fake, and every time they want to get rid of you, they're just like, oh, we're going to change the platform, and then they don't run on it. But on the other hand, when I was like watching Cornel West, for instance, go at it with Robert Wexler, I was like, yeah, like come on, like this is big. This never really happened. So I don't know. I mean, is it just like a meaningless sop to trick us into supporting Clinton? Or does this mark a real turning point in where the conversation on the Palestinian conflict is going?
No, I mean, I think that this is actually a turning point. Obviously, the platform is symbolic and pretty meaningless. I mean, obviously, presidents have broken with it in the past. There's nothing binding about it. The important thing here is the fact that you have a conversation that's happening in the open, not even a conversation, like an antagonistic argument that's taking place about the issue around the issue of Israel in the Democratic Party, and it's happening in front of people's eyes. I think it really started when Sanders and Clinton had that debate, and I mean, it wasn't even that radical. Sanders was just like, "Yeah, Palestinians are like human beings," you know, and everybody was like, "Whoa,
crazy!
Really just say you're gonna lose," you know,
right?
But that, I mean, that right there, like the, when that kind of stuff happens, it's a big deal just because it brings the conversation into the open, which is mm-hmm. something you don't see around this particular issue.
No,
it's so censored.
Yeah, China, go ahead.
I do think, I mean, to that point, bringing up Bernie Sanders, that the more folks who stand up, particularly Jewish people, again, we talk about having to work with folks in power, the more folks who stand up against this.
Skirting the edges there. Go ahead.
I mean, my point is Palestinians can't do it by themselves. Like, right. we have to get other folks on board, because I totally agree with all of you. A little segue, but I think is also relevant to this, all of us, like, getting to this situation with gun violence and gun ownership prevention. I actually believe, even though we've had Sandy Hook, you would think there would have been change from that. This particular incident in Orlando has affected the LGBT community. And we all know how very powerful white men are. And they are at the front of the LGBT community. So once again, when you have white men stepping up, like Bernie says, saying, hey, this is an issue, even though folks kind of don't respect him, unfortunately. But when you have white men stepping up, and I think there will be more folks stepping up against this, about this Palestine-Israel conflict, then I think we'll see change. So yeah. I think Rhonda's yeah. right that we're going to start to see change because of the folks who are stepping up.
Yeah, well, Bomani, I want to come to you well, to yeah, this, but and, no, Rhonda, go ahead, please.
Oh, well, I was going to say the fact that Sanders is Jewish, too. I mean, like that was even if he was a white man alone, like a white Christian, it's like, you know, he could have easily been portrayed as an anti-Semite. But it's just harder to do it with a guy whose like family was killed in the Holocaust.
Right.
Like
right.
Sanders was.
Absolutely.
So like Sanders' family was. So like Clinton couldn't even come back at him with that. And that's largely why she didn't attack him much on the issue. But you're absolutely right about all that. But one thing I just do want to say about the platform is. Also, this is really like the progressive base of the Democratic Party, the Democratic liberals. It's the opinions about Israel-Palestine have shifted dramatically just within the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Liberal Democratic support for Palestinians over Israel has actually doubled.
Wow.
Within the past 2 years. That's pretty dramatic.
And there's big support for BDS too, right? I mean, you wrote an article about that recently.
Well, so there's a lot of support for BDS among college, like among young people, young liberals, but just in general, college students in general across the board, because young people are just so liberal. There's not very many of them who are right wing. And these are polls that have been done by like the right wing propaganda consultants mm-hmm. on this issue. And they're freaking out about it because they recognize that the future generation is going to be made up of people who are very hostile towards Israel. I mean, Israel's also becoming a partisan issue, even though it's not quite partisan yet. At the top of the parties,
right.
It's becoming a partisan issue where Republicans are like the pro-Israel, pro-Netanyahu party, and then Democrats are the ones who are like boycotting Netanyahu's speech when he's coming to, you know, talk
mm-hmm. Bomani, get in there.
Just because it ties in with a subject that's really near and dear to my heart.
Please.
I do think a lot of times what we talk about in the Israeli-Palestine conflict is a lot of smoke fighting, and we don't really get to the fire of it. I know personally, and just from researching and understanding how this country thinks, one of the main reasons that there's a shift against Israel in our thinking of Palestine is our shift away from religion.
Yeah.
As a culture, taking religion less seriously. Like the main idea, the reason Israel exists is because this culture, Western culture, the United States of America, believes those people have a right over the land. Like we grew up. For some reason, now that I look back at it, when I was a child in Sunday school, I was rooting for the Israelites in the Battle of Jericho.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? And now I'm older and I realize how twisted that is.
Right.
That someone comes from a land they've never been before, killed everyone and right. took it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
This.
And
killed everyone because God told him to.
God told him to.
Yeah.
And that is a basic idea of Western culture, that they have permission from God to go take stuff. And so as we're moving away from that, maybe not being how the world should work. And then all of a sudden we're like, so what did Palestine do to deserve the treatment that they have now? And I think we need to address that directly.
There's also where like generations, it's like we're generations after like the Holocaust, where it's not as fresh. It's not as, because I mean, the Holocaust has been extremely exploited
mm-hmm.
to try and like to legitimize.
And Israel should not have been the solution to the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Of course not. But it's been used for so long as a way to say, shut up, stop criticizing Israel.
Right.
And now it just does, it's been so overplayed. It doesn't really have that kick anymore. And it's also so many generations ago. And then beyond that, like, I think that the people who are really helping us the most on this issue are Israeli leaders because they're just insane.
Right. Yeah.
Like, they say the craziest things. They're just increasingly right wing, increasingly like shifting towards fascism. And they say, I mean, they literally just like openly make genocidal statements.
I mean, it really is unbelievable.
And Bomani, let me ask you maybe to broaden the frame a little bit, because I think it's a good point about sort of the cultural shift underlying kind of the political shift. And I wonder on so many other issues, I mean, how much sort of social, cultural spade work, or I guess how important is that to sort of maybe laying the groundwork for political change to have that different frame? Because I was thinking, I saw just a crazy poll number today that 66% of white people between 17 and 34 are against affirmative action. And I don't know why I was surprised at that. I would have thought like 42. Cool, but like 66, whoa.
So especially
when younger people are supposed to be more liberal.
So to tie it in, how you introduced me as Mr. Read a Book, right? One thing that we know as educators is the more you read, the more, especially the more, even fiction, the more you read, the more you understand other people and their stories, mm-hmm. the more you're able to empathize. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's going on. We can't empathize with other people's stories. I've been fortunate. I can't say that I've gone out of my way to find empathy for other people. I've been put in positions where I've learned about Palestine, where I've learned, you know what I'm saying? And the more you understand people, the more you'll have some feeling for them. But people, like, take pride in their xenophobia. You know what I'm saying? They take pride mm-hmm. in the fact that they can't tell you anything about Islam. You know what I'm saying? They think that's actually good.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And it's like there's a level of understanding and reading and understanding someone else's story that even if you, after reading their story, you disagree with them, you can still come from a position of understanding and finding somewhere in between. And this country prides itself on its ignorance on many levels.
I actually think that's the number because we no longer have a middle class. And so
yeah, that's what I was going to go with.
Even white kids are like, I heard, to Bomani's point too, I heard that black people had it rough once upon
really
a time.
They don't really sort of get it, yeah.
But
is it really
bad? I got $200,000 worth of student loans too. I'm having to move back with my parents and eat ramen noodles and pizza too. Like they don't now see themselves differently, especially now with reality TV. You see black people, you know, you think black people are in the come up. So they don't see like this black or Latino or Native American. They don't see that oppression as compared to them because they believe they are oppressed.
I saw that can of worms open as well. Yeah. The minute she opened it.
Yeah. I'm just like terrified. First, if anyone is thinking that like reality TV, like if you're like, man, black people are way better because reality TV.
Absolutely.
But like, man, we are more trouble than
But black people participate in that.
Yeah.
Participate in that we have to look like we're making it.
We're also so segregated that some people really don't know any black people.
Right.
The only black people
right.
they see are depictions
right.
on TV.
Absolutely.
And if those depictions are all Jay-Z and Beyonce,
right.
it's like, you know, like, right. oh, they're doing great. Like,
yeah. Well, but Monty, keep the point going, though. I mean, about us participating, because I think that's, I mean, obviously we can lay as much as we want at the doorstep of the major media, because
right.
obviously they're terrible. But,
right.
I mean, what is the, I guess, to steal a term from Republicans, the personal responsibility element?
So I honestly think just as black people, we just have to start, I mean, people in general. But, you know, I'm black people. I got a lot of black people in my family. My mom's black. You know what I'm saying? My dad's black, too. You know what I'm saying? And one of the things that we've always discovered is that from the point that we gained our freedom, our intent has been to impress and to integrate.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
And the system that oppressed us in the first place did not go away. It morphed. It changed.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But we're like, in order to be a part of it, we just have to show the system that we can be a part of the system and Uber, like, super...
Yeah.
super versions of the system instead of sitting back and being like, this is the system that created the depths mm-hmm. of depravity that we are in.
Yeah.
How do we I don't blame, like, I can point directly at the generations before us that told us
yeah.
to be bigger, be faster, keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them. That was that, you know, 2-3 generations out of what we were coming through, you know, how do you do it? But now that we've sat back and looked at it, do we really want to participate? Do we want to be a part of the country that's oppressing Palestine?
Right. It's the entire, like, the rhetoric around the American dream. When you hear American, you know, that there's this American, the white picket fence, the dog,
right.
the two and a half children, a dog,
and
the
half.
Wife with the husband, you know, all of that stuff. Within that lies this, like, systematic oppression.
Right, that no one who is not white lived
yep, yep,
out there. I mean,
yep.
really, I mean, I think Rania's right. I said this to the producer of this show the other day, the most, like, depressing thing for me is when they release those maps of how segregated everyone is, like the color-coded maps.
Oh, yeah,
and you realize that, 99% of people are basically living only with people just like them. And I think to your point, Bomani, it's like an immigrationist like this is so assimilationist. It's a class assimilationism, right? Like you have to, like if you, it's all good if we all have on like, you know, boat shoes, khakis, we're at the country club, you got the right degrees, you vacation at the right spots, then it's like we all can be equal. But as soon as you have like that discordant note, it's like this homogenous sort of class assimilationist based off this white Anglo-Saxon culture that, quite frankly, is really like almost in and of itself, not almost, is its own sort of social creation. So just the layers beneath the layers of these identities that have been created and invested with so much power, it's crazy. But, you know, I'll flip it back to you really quickly, China, because I just wonder, you know, look, just how is it we can, after Obama, still be getting ready to be like, let's vote for Hillary because she's the first woman. I mean, look, we should have a woman everything. Like, we need more women in all institutions. But how do we not say, like, well, what does this person stand for? Because I feel like with Obama, a lot of people were just like, man, he's going to change the world, invest these hopes and dreams because he just because he was going to be the first black president. And that would be so transcendent. All things would change. So how are we now in a position where if you don't support Hillary Clinton, it's like, you know, you're two steps ahead of the Stanford rapist?
Well, I think, wow. Okay. That was a comparison.
Your choices.
Shout out Joan Walsh.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I talk about and advocate for voting for Hillary Clinton, I actually speak differently than my counterparts. I never talk about that she was a state senator, that she's the first lady, that she's secretary of state, or use the rhetoric that she's a woman. What being a woman means is that she has a perspective that is lacking in the that has been lacking in the White House and that still lacks in the Congress because we don't have parity in Congress or in the Senate. So it's not just about her having a, dare I say, a vagina. It's about her making considerations that men don't make, and not because they don't want to make them, but just like black folks, you don't have to think about when you walk outside, oh my God, should I pull my pants up? Am I supposed to have a hoodie? I have on a hoodie. Oh my God. Da-da-da-da. Like, there are things as when I walk out the door as a woman, I understand I'm going to be subjected to that men do not understand. And so she brings all of that. They just passed in Texas, taking off, not Texas, New York, taking the tax off of feminine products. Like, that's just not something men, again, not that they don't support it, but it's just not something that is at the front of their mind. So not being a woman as in she has a vagina, but being a woman as in she has an experience that the folks who currently dominate our elected seats do not have.
But in a way, isn't it like, doesn't she have to suppress that? That piece, but I don't know. It just seems like when Obama came out, it was like he was black when he fought against being black. But I'm gonna let Rania get in, the other woman on the show. It seems like that's the right thing to do.
Right.
Well, I gotta say, like, so I've even been called, because I'm very adamantly opposed to the idea of Hillary Clinton being president for a number of reasons. And one of my main reasons is the effects of the policy decisions that she's made throughout her entire career on women. They've been horrible. I mean, women don't seem to, or maybe certain women, like women, Hillary Clinton's feminism is very selective, if you even want to call it feminism. There's a whole host of women who are completely left out of her feminism. And that includes women in this country, when we're talking about like women who were screwed over because of welfare reform, which is something Hillary Clinton helped push. Or when we're talking about women in other countries, for example, you know, in the women in Central America, if you want to talk about Berta Cáceres, who was killed by a death squad that came about from the coup in Honduras that as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton helped push. Or when we're talking about Libya and what the women in Libya are experiencing in a country that Hillary Clinton's policy, I mean, she spearheaded the overthrow of the regime in Libya. And that has led to like ISIS literally having a safe haven in Libya.
Bomani, jump in here. Just, like, hold on. We only got about a minute left.
My biggest fear is, and I feel like Condoleezza Rice kind of confirmed it for me a little bit. And that is the reason we got Barack Obama. My fear is that he would prove that he can rule like a white man. And I fear that Hillary Clinton is going out of her way to prove that she can rule like a white man. I think like her war hawkishness, and I don't even know if I'm up on it enough, but I've heard people debate whether or not, like, that's compensating. You know what I'm saying? As a woman, as a woman maybe thought of being soft, you have to be like, no, I am not soft. I can be as militaristic, if not more than men. And I don't know if that, you know, if that's possibly happening there.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's so much that can be said on this topic. We're going to leave it there for today. We're going to keep talking about all these things. Thank you so much to all of our guests, and you have been listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.